This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
G'day, Jess Hayes with you today. Back after a few weeks off, back at home on the farm. Turns out I'm definitely more of a journo than a chaser bin driver, so I won't be giving up my day job anytime soon. I'll be in the chair for Belinda Varischetti all of this week, and it's great to have you with me today. Now, how do you like your strawberries? Traditionally, it's all about that deep red colour. What about a variety with white flesh?
They're just so different looking, but the red seeds make it. They're just beautiful. And that's how you tell that these ones are ripe, when they have red seeds, when they go red.
Queensland scientist Dr. Jodie Neal there. She's helping develop those white strawberries. You'll catch up with her a bit later in the program. You'll also get a wrap of the weather across the state at 12:30. Bit of a mixed bag from the looks of things. I'll be catching up with Noel Pusey with all the details. But up first on today's program, we've heard a lot about these trade tensions with China and the fact that a range of Australian commodities have been pulled into the diplomatic void, such as rock lobster, wine and barley. But what about iron ore? How safe is that market, which has been so important to the Australian economy? Well, one Chinese industry body is reportedly pushing for a probe into why the price of Australian iron ore has rallied to eight-year highs during 2020. James Lawrenson is from the Australia-China Relations Institute, an independent non-partisan research institute which studies relationships between the two countries. James, are we naive in thinking that iron ore won't be brought into this?
Yeah, look, I think we're right to assume that this will remain free from Chinese government hits. The truth is that China relies on Australian ore far too much for it to shoot itself in the foot. So as we know, the numbers have continued growing this year, and I think it's a pretty safe bet that that will continue.
James, the West Australian has today reported that because the leap in spot prices that we've seen is threatening they're saying it's threatening the profitability of the mills and potentially forcing production cuts, and that means that the China Iron and Steel Association wants Chinese regulators to look into that jump in prices and crack down on any wrongdoing. Do you think this should serve as a bit of a warning for Australian mining companies, and should we be worried about that at all?
No, I still wouldn't be panicking for a couple of reasons. One, the China Iron Ore and Steel Association has a very long track record of complaining about iron ore prices when they start to rise. This is an industry association, after all. It's their job. So I think we should look at the facts and the evidence. And look, the reality is that over this year, Australia's been shipping more iron ore to China than ever before. And yet the prices continue to rise. So there's really only a couple explanations. Then tight supply from other countries like Brazil and strong Chinese demand. I mean, I think those are the sort of the fundamental factors that Australian resources companies will be focused on rather than panicking that the Chinese government might have them in their sights.
James, could there be any truth at all to the suggestion that the market has been manipulated in some way by Australian mining exporters?
No. Basically, because, look, we have access to trade data, and actually we have access to Chinese government trade data. So when I said before that Australian producers are selling more volume of iron ore to China than ever before, I'm not citing the Australian government for that, I'm citing the Chinese government. So the fundamentals of robust and stable supply from Australia, that's continued during the year.
How reliable is that data out of China?
Well, this is coming from China's customs statistics. They have absolutely no incentive to falsify the amount of iron ore they're buying from Australia, so I treat it with a high degree of confidence.
I'm joined by James Lawrenson from the Australian-China Relations Institute. James, former Federal Resources Minister Matt Canavan has called on the government to, I guess, force Beijing to pay a price for its trade bans by imposing a levy on iron ore exports to China. He suggests a 1% levy would raise around $800 million a year, which could support sectors that are hit by these recent trade bans. What's your take on that proposition?
Well, to be frank, my take is that it's madness. Look, Australia's national interest isn't served by accelerating China getting its iron ore from other countries. And I saw Matt Canavan said that they're already doing that to some extent. Well, fine, but we don't want to accelerate it, and we don't want to leave ourselves with a permanently lower share of China's iron ore imported iron ore market. And look, the second thing, I just think it is very short-sighted. What next? Say we hit our iron ore exports to China. That's the big and perhaps only source of leverage that Australia has in the bilateral trade relationship. China will, of course, retaliate. That's to be expected. What do we do then? Well, we've got no more leverage left. So, you know, China's behaviour this year towards Australia has been disgraceful, frankly, but we don't serve Australia's national interests by reacting to that, by shooting ourselves in the foot.
So Resources Minister Keith Pitt has ruled out any retaliatory tariffs against China, but has reminded Beijing that it's unlikely to be able to replace Australia as a source of iron ore. But there are some countries that are seen as potential threats, which you've talked about there, such as Guinea or Brazil, as potential competitors. And it's widely recognised that those countries do face some significant challenges despite China's efforts to streamline those supply chains. Do we realistically see any of those challenges being overcome anytime soon and those threats being expedited?
No, look, I think we're in a pretty comfortable position for the next 5 years. Look, it's natural, particularly if iron ore prices stay high as they currently are, then naturally alternative sources of supply will open up, both within China and in other countries. So look, these sources of competition, we need to keep an eye on them. But in the end, I think we've got a lot of good reasons, fundamental reasons to be confident that Australia is the world's lowest cost supplier of quality iron ore.
So no imminent threat realistically?
No, that's what the facts and evidence points to. And given robust Chinese demand and limited supply elsewhere, I think the iron ore miners will be pretty happy with their outlook for the next 12 months, even beyond that, the next few years.
Now, it has been a pretty remarkable year for iron ore. I'm looking at a graph here that shows the spot price was sitting at around $80 a tonne in February. Today, that price is sitting at around $150 a tonne. So some real exponential growth this year. This might be a bit of a silly question, but for the layman, why has that price gone up so much?
Two factors. Limited supply from elsewhere. So Brazil's supply has obviously been hit because of natural disasters in that country, meaning that Australia is the dominant supplier now, so there's not a lot of alternative sources. And the second thing is the Chinese government has responded to the COVID-19 economic shock in the way it normally does, and that is with a big round of infrastructure building. Now, that infrastructure building is steel-intensive, and to make that steel, China needs iron ore, and it gets the iron ore from Australia. So there's the robust demand factor that's coming into those rising prices.
The WA government, our Treasurer Ben Wyatt today has released the mid-year financial review, and it cites WA's strong economic recovery as exceeding expectations. Just to quote, it says, in 2020-21, the forecast net operating surplus has been revised up to $2.2 billion from $1.2 billion at the budget delivered in early October, with stronger than expected surpluses anticipated over the forward estimates. So can we expect that the good times will continue, James?
I think you've got good reasons to be optimistic. Of course, the prices are not going to stay at $160 per tonne, but that's, you know, really touching off historical highs. So you can expect them to come back. But will they remain well above historical averages because of strong Chinese demand and limited supply from other options? Yes, I think there's a lot of reasons to be confident in that scenario.
James, a bit of a crystal ball question here. I mean, what happens from here? What are we expecting? It's a difficult one, I know.
Look, the best estimates I've seen from academic studies, for example, they point to China's steel production not hitting a peak until the mid-2020s. And look, as long as that's the case, then China's demand for Australian ore will remain strong. Obviously, over the longer term, when China gets to more and more advanced stages of development, it's not going to need to build so much infrastructure and we'll see a gradual fall. But I think the key point is that China's demand, when it does finally come off the ball, will be a gradual decline. It's not going to be falling off a cliff. So I guess my crystal ball says that the China-Western Australia economic relationship, the one built around iron ore, is set to remain solid for a long time to come.
Thank you for those insights, James. That's James Lawrenson. He's a director of the Australia-China Relations Institute based at the University of Technology in Sydney. It's quarter past 12, just coming up to a quarter past 12. If you'd like to be a part of the conversation today, remember you can always flick me a text through on 0448 922 604. That's 0448 892 604. Now, sticking with China for another minute, there's another critical aspect of Canberra and Beijing's relationship that's proving just as contentious. Earlier this year, the federal government imposed a big crackdown on foreign investment into Australia amid the fears the coronavirus would leave businesses exposed to predatory overseas investors. Lachlan Molesworth is a director at Foreign Investment Advisory Australia and was a former advisor to Scott Morrison when he was the Treasurer. He says the changes have made it much harder for Chinese investors in an apparent signal to Beijing.
The reduction in thresholds by the government was done with a policy intention to effectively ensure that all foreign investment applications into Australia are reviewed and screened. And the reason why it was thought that was necessary was particularly it was COVID. There was a concern that asset prices in Australia would plummet and that we would have bargain buying, if you like, from foreign investors from overseas, people sort of sweeping in, vulture fund sort of capacity to pick things up. There is no doubt that there has been, I think, in certain sectors, an uptick in interest. So if you're looking at sort of commercial property, for instance, where prices have fallen, particularly in the listed sector, entities from overseas have come in, they've tried to buy up and make most of that asset deflation. Other sectors haven't, for instance. I mean, agriculture, I don't think, has at all.
There was a concern when the rules were brought in that some foreign buyers might be turned off. You know, they might essentially reallocate capital that they could have deployed to Australia elsewhere in the world. Has that turned out to be the case?
In the last 6 months, there's been concern, but people have been prepared to sort of to do it because of the unusual market situation. Investors are becoming very aware of these new hurdles. They're becoming aware of the additional time now required. Now, previously, you could enter into a deal, you can negotiate, you could buy it, you could enter a transaction and buy an Australian asset. The time frame was dictated by what you could do commercially. Now, the bottleneck is whether or not you can get FIRB approval. At the moment, we haven't seen too much of an impact, but again, investors are becoming very aware of that. It will, in the longer term, change sentiment.
The Foreign Investment Review Board, or the federal government, however you want to look at it, doesn't release too much data. Invariably, when it does, there's a pretty significant time lag on that data.
Correct. Pretty historical.
Yeah. So what would you expect that data to be saying right now about the foreign investment picture?
Firstly, the number of approvals are right up, but the number of approvals will be right up because such a large additional number of transactions now caught because all the thresholds have dropped. However, if you look at the investment at the upper higher value level, from our experience, and this is just seeing our own deal flow and just talking to colleagues, there is probably a slowing of interest by private investors. I think that is probably tied a little bit to the increased work which has to be done in order to be able to invest here and get through the net. I think there still seems to be a lot of foreign government investor interest. I think as a class of investor, there's a lot of cashed up FGIs, as we call them. Even though markets are sort of subject to turmoil, which sort of scares private investors, they are resilient. And I think that their demand is probably as high, if not higher, than ever.
With respect to foreign government investment, how is that being treated?
The rules were tightened in about 2015 in Australia. And what that meant was that Australia made the decision, the policy decision, Australian government. If you're a foreign government investor, you should always have a $0 threshold applied to you. So the $0 threshold has applied for many, many years. So technically those changes, the statutory changes, don't affect foreign government investors because they're already in that category. However, when an application goes in, every case is assessed on its merits and every case is assessed with regard to current day issues, concerns, advice, and the level of scrutiny can be ratcheted up or ratcheted down depending on that environment. And that includes, I think it's safe to say, the diplomatic environment as well, as to what is perceived to be in Australia's national interest when approving or rejecting an application for investment or an application to enter into a transaction on Australian soil.
So does that mean, for example, that some foreign government investment would be treated perhaps a bit more favourably or a little bit more leniently than other types of foreign government investment, depending on that diplomatic environment?
I think that's safe to say. I think that certain investors, a much higher level of scrutiny is applied. There are probably more hurdles to jump through than others.
Speaking of the diplomatic environment, there's no secret of the fact that the relationship between China and Australia seems to be a little strained at the moment. How is Chinese foreign government investment being treated right now?
There is no doubt that diplomatically it is a bit of a brave new world, and that relationships, I think, are more strained. I think it's fair to say that that does play out in the sort of scrutiny that we apply in Australia to proposals which involve foreign government investment from places such as China. I think that that does affect Australian willingness to want to approve deals, to want to see investment in Australia, in particularly in sectors which are very sensitive.
Is there still interest from Chinese state-owned enterprises or entities in Australia and investing in Australia?
I think that there is absolutely no doubt that there is still a hell of a lot of interest to be able to acquire assets, and very major assets, in Australia.
Foreign Investment Advisory Australia Director Lachlan Molesworth, he was speaking to Daniel Mercer, and Treasurer Josh Frydenberg referred to the statement last week in which he announced changes that would be replaced with a new set of rules on January the 21st. So under the new rules, the federal government will keep the $0 screening thresholds for proposed investments on sensitive assets. The Treasurer would also be given new powers to forcibly divest assets even if they've previously been approved for sale. And you can read more on that story on the ABC Rural website. There's a link on the ABC Rural Facebook page. You can have your say in the comments underneath. There's already some comments. It's going off a bit. We've got a comment from Rob here who says, good, it should extend to all foreign ownership. Diane says, about time. And Irene says, good. None of our assets should be for sale. If you want to have your say on the text line, you can always flick me through a text on 0448 922 604. Now, commercial crayfishing operators in Western Australia can now sell 200 crays a day from the back of their boat. That's double what they could previously sell. The reason for the change to regulations is that up until the start of November, most crays or rock lobsters caught in WA were exported live to China. Well, that trade shut its door quickly and looks to be firmly closed. Western Rock Lobster Council CEO Matt Taylor is happy with this latest change, but says the industry is still in a lot of pain.
Back of boat sales has been quite popular, and the boats that are providing those lobsters to the community were interested in raising the level. The demand is there, and they're not necessarily fishing every day, and they would be able to supply more into the community. So we requested that of Minister Tinley, and he approved.
How many boats would be roughly participating in this scheme?
It is hard to say at the moment, and there's not every boat is fishing at the moment as well. So I would say there's probably a handful along the coast in each port that are participating in the back of boat sales.
What are they as a business getting out of it? The price varies, but working on roughly $20 a cray, that's about $40 a kilo. Is the fishing business making money on that, or is this more beneficial from a community engagement perspective?
It's both really, Joe. It's really trying to maximise the value that the fishers can get from their quota. Really, it's big for the industry as well in regards to promotion. So just engagement with the community, having people come down to the boats, talk to the fishermen, see how they operate, pick out a lobster live from a tank, and just engage and hear the stories from the fishermen is really important for our industry. And we've been trying to increase our industry promotion and community connection for a number of years now, and primarily through local suppliers as well. So it's great that we've been able to produce this system this year that's been able to do that.
I wanted to ask you about that because we've been having that conversation about a local lobster industry for quite some time. Is it a bit of a disappointment that it takes a trade shutdown to really progress it and to have that government and community and fishermen support finally at this point?
To be honest, Joe, we were already sort of planning the increase in the availability and accessibility into the local market. In a way, the market closure earlier this year has really just accelerated how quickly we've done it and I guess the scale to which we've been able to do it. But certainly the conversations were quite extensive last year in particular. So we'd already done a fair bit of groundwork in determining a system and trying to increase the availability and accessibility.
Is this a starting point for furthering some sort of local lobster industry?
As an industry, we're certainly keen to increase supply to the local community. So we've been working on that. I do think it's the start of a long-term readjustment to see more domestic sales. And certainly as an industry, we're looking to benefit other sectors as well in terms of retail, restaurants, etc., and hospitality and tourism, as well as regional development for those coastal communities.
Looking at that domestic market in the context of the amount of lobster that fishers were taking, I think we're looking at roughly 6,500 tonnes, so that's 6.5 million kilos. I imagine there's still a lot of lobster that needs a home.
Oh, no, I mean, the local market is really a fraction of the production. In terms of scale, it's very low. Western Australia exports more lobster than the rest of Australia and New Zealand combined. So we're certainly a very dominant fishery by global standards. But for us, yeah, we just want to make sure that we're meeting local demand and we want to increase that. So people that might never have bought a lobster before, we want to encourage them to know where to buy it from and then also how you can cook it in simple ways so that people are prepared to take that step to purchase and enjoy the beautiful product that it is. But, yeah, the domestic market itself is a very small portion of the total production.
Do you have any insight, Matt, into if we are likely to see that Chinese trade resume anytime soon?
Oh, I guess at this stage we're not overly optimistic about the resumption of trade with China. We are fully focused on identifying other markets and servicing those markets with our product. And if China comes back on board, you know, we'll be more than happy to service that market as well. But at this stage, our focus is really on market diversification and looking at other export opportunities.
I have noticed that the WA lobster industry has been quite careful to say nothing really publicly about the Chinese trade and that the impact of closing down that market essentially. Why is that? Why the silence?
Well, there's really no upside for our industry to comment. It's a political issue at a trade level. There is no issue between our industry and China. Their traders want the product. Their consumers want the product. Our fishers want to export and our industry has a fantastic trading relationship with China, with its people, its consumers and traders. So at our level, there's no problem whatsoever. This is a very serious time. The whole economics of the industry have changed as a result of this. And there's a lot of financial pain out there in the industry as well. So our focus at the moment is really working with state and federal governments to look at new trade opportunities and open doors for our product to go into new markets. That's really what's going to underpin the industry into the future.
Matt Taylor from the Western Rock Lobster Council, he was speaking to Joe Prendergast. Matt was also saying some people are missing out on the back of boat sales. So if that's you and you're keen to get your hands on some crays and support the industry, there is a handy link on the Western Rock Lobsters Council's website. website. And news just in a short while ago, the state government has announced it'll be investing $14.4 million towards wild dog control. A statement from the government released this morning says the funding will support the rollout of the WA Wild Dog Action Plan between 2021 and 2025. The money will fund further research to upgrades to the state barrier fence to keep it maintained, the employment of 8 new doggers, university-led research into sterilising dogs in remote Aboriginal communities, as well as best practice wild dog management workshops. It's just coming up to 12:30. I'm joined in the studio by Jonathan Hopper. Jonathan, what's making news?
Afternoon, Jess. The WA Treasurer says nearly all the jobs lost since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic have been recovered. Ben Wyatt has released details of the mid-year review, saying a gross state product, gross state demand and employment growth have all been stronger than expected. The federal government says it'll work constructively with New Zealand as it moves to establish a trans-Tasman travel bubble with Australia. Since October, New Zealanders have been able to travel to Australia without going into quarantine in certain states, but not the other way around. The change would be conditional on coronavirus case levels staying low and pending approval by the federal government. And US President Donald Trump has tweeted White House staff will not be among the first in America to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Top White House staff, including Mr. Trump and Vice President, were due to get the Pfizer jab today, with a government official saying it was in the interest of ensuring continuity of government. Thanks, Jess.
Thank you for that update from the newsroom, Jonathan Hopper. A few texts coming in on that crackdown on Chinese foreign investment into Australian assets. Sue says, I cannot believe China is looking into whether Australia has possibly manipulated the price of iron ore. Is this the same China that slapped tariffs on our barley, 206% tariffs and taxes on our wines, stopped our crayfish industry and other commodities under false pretenses to take advantage themselves? It's disgusting and disgraceful. And Helen says, why not let China invest in Australia the same percent that Australia is allowed to invest in China? Keen to hear from you. Feel free to flick me a text. Join the conversation, 0448 922 604. In a moment, I'll be joined by Richard Hudson, who will have the latest rainfall totals from the last 24 hours. It looks like there's been a few falls around the southwest, which is a bit frustrating for anyone sitting on a header or trying to, but some very happy pastoralists in the north and on the Nullarbor, and we'll hear more from one producer shortly. But up first, we'll get a wrap from the Bureau. I'm joined by Noel Pusey. Noel, what can we expect across the southwest land division?
High pressure ridge developing south of the state at the moment, Jess. A little bit of shower activity along the south coast in the wake of that sort of frontal feature went through last night and got a little bit of rainfall, including the Perth metro area there. But hopefully not too much in the way it falls inland to upset too many people there, but with the halves going on. But it looks like the next few days, again, possibly a shower or two along the south coast in the morning tomorrow, but very, very near coastal stuff. I don't think it'll penetrate too far inland. And we'll see a trough develop near the west coast with the gradual warming trend slowly over the next four days or so, I think, towards the weekend, up to the sort of low to mid-30s near the west coast by the weekend, and until then, probably in the low 30s. And we'll see a little bit of thunderstorm activity developing down the trough too. I think it'll remain mostly in the northern Gascoyne for Tuesday, but during Wednesday it looks like it will extend a little bit further south and sort of come down to south and east of Perth and across towards sort of Lake Grace, that sort of area through the Great Southern and much of the wheat belt in the afternoon and evening. I think you'd be pretty unlucky to get much in the way of falls out of it unless you're directly under one of the thunderstorms that doesn't move anywhere. But I think in general, risk of lightning strikes is probably the main issue there. It's mostly sort of mid-level driven stuff in the trough there. So hopefully it won't affect the harvest too much through there. But we'll see things start to clear during Thursday. The trough remains fairly stationary, but generally the mid-level feature causing the thunderstorms moves away, and we're left with some shower activity through the goldfields and towards the Eucla, perhaps during later Wednesday and into Thursday, also maybe Friday into the Eucla, and then moving up through the interior as the trough moves away. But perhaps more interest to people in the north, it looks like we'll have showers and thunderstorms off and on through the Kimberley, the Pilbara and areas in the north there over the next few days. There's generally some flood warnings still continuing for parts of the De Grey Catchment and other areas there too. But We do have another tropical low developing, looks like through the weekend and the early part of next week. So we'll be looking at sort of in the longer term, at least anyway, some tropical activity for the sort of lead up to Christmas. So it could be an interesting time in here, I think, over the next sort of next week or so as we watch the development of that tropical low as it extends from to the northwest of sort of to Darwin, down the Kimberley coast, and possibly sort of threatening the Pilbara or the Kimberley coast sort of Tuesday, Wednesday of next week.
And given that lightning you mentioned there, Noel, are we looking at any warnings at the moment?
The warnings are not there's fire weather warnings for the west Pilbara and the west Pilbara and the northwest Gascoyne, but nothing for the southwest land division at present. The only warnings current are coastal waters, a strong wind warnings all the way from Onslow down the west coast all the way south to Dawsville. So strong sea breeze this afternoon causing that fire danger as well, and very similar conditions for tomorrow too.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that update from the Bureau, Noel Pusey. A bit of a mixed bag by the sounds of things. I'm joined in the studio now by Richard Hudson. Richard, big list to get through today.
Medium size, I'd call it. So this is the rainfall figures for the weekend, starting in the northern and eastern forecast districts. So in the Kimberley, Bidgidanga 14, Broome Airport 11, Country Downs 40, Curtin Airport 15, Dampier Downs Airstrip 44, Dabisa 27, Derby Airport 29, Diggers Rest 7, Doongan 5, Drysdale River Station 9, Ellenbrae 32, Fitzroy Crossing Airport had 19, Flora Valley 32, Fossil Downs 13, Gibb River 9, Halls Creek Airport 16, Columbaroo 45, Kimbolton 31, Lansdowne 34, Larrawarr 24, Leopold Downs 25, Liveringa Station had 15, that was over 4 days, Lombardina Airport 10, Mandorah 23, Margaret River Airstrip 23 as well, Marion Downs 18, Mount Amherst had 75, Mount House Airstrip 50, Mount Krause 33, Mount Winifred 71, Napier Downs 5, Nicholson 25, Nida Downs 9, Old Mornington Homestead had 40, and Port Smith had 35. Port Smith has been getting a fair bit of rain in the last five or so days. Siddons Creek 9, Sturt Creek 14, Udiella 8, Warman 5, West Roebuck 17, Winjana Gorge 11, Yampie Sound 52, and Yulumbu had 46. And then some lovely falls in the Pilbara as well. Bonnie Downs another 68, Carlindy 52, Indy 74, Carrageenie North had 26, Marble Bar 85, that's unusual for Marble Bar, normally renowned for its 48 degree temperature.
I was going to say, dry as a chip, Richard.
I always feel for the Black Angus cows that are out at Marble Bar. There are some there too.
Be a bit hot and sweaty, yes.
Yeah. Newman Airport 19, Pardoo only had 3, Port Hedland Airport 21, Wallarinia 37, Warrawagine 12, Yaleen 10, and Yarri had 33. Then in the Gascoyne region, only one worth reading out, and that's Murchison with 9. A bit of rain in the interior, though. Carnegie, 48. Lorna Glen, 6. Prenti Downs, 10. Chuckyilla, 74. And Warburton Airfield had 84. And then out in the goldfields, Edgedina had 9. That's the only one at 5 or above. And a bit on the Eucla as well, in the Eucla district. Eucla itself, 27. Air, 19. Forest, 32. Mundrabilla Station, 105.
105.
Came out of the blue, didn't it? And even a bit of rain out on the islands. Barrow Island Airport had 13. And then nowhere near as much rain in the Southwest Land Division. In the Central West, Coolangatta had 8, and at the Alert Station, 6. Lower West, Bickley had 8. Dwelling Up, Gingin West and Mundaring all had 6 mils. Carrigullen North, 7. And then in the southwest, Beetle Up, 17. Boyan Up North, 8. Brunswick Junction and Bunbury both had 5. Kawarram Up, 8. Darden Up had 6 to 7 mils. Ferguson Valley, 5 to 7. So this is areas that have a number of recording stations. That's why I give the range. Henty Brook had 6, Manjimup 5 to 10, Margaret River 7 to 12, Mount William 5, Nanup 30, and at the Deepherd only 6. Northcliffe had 12, and at the Deepherd station 13. Pemberton 11, Quinnen Up 14, Shannon 13, Walpole Forestry 8, Willy Abra up 11, and Windy Harbour 6. And then just a little bit in the southern coastal region worth reading out, Albany 8 and at the airport 1 mil more than that, Denmark 10 and at the Denmark Deepherd Station 14 and King River had 8. Nothing more than 1 mil in the entire central wheat belt, and then in the great southern region just one location had anything worth reading out, and that was Franklin, which had 10 mils. But some of the stations, even out on the Nullarbor Plain, also got some much-needed rain over the weekend. So that region has recently experienced one of its driest spells on record. We had Emma, our reporter down in Esperance, who was down there for a while, went out to some of those Nullarbor properties and had a chat to some of them. They've had to either partially or fully restock. Rawlinna Station is one of them. It's about 370 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie, so it's on the trans-access line. It normally runs about 60,000 sheep, believe it or not. It's a big property, but the flock on Rawlinna is now about half that size. Jimmy Woods, the manager, and he says sections of their huge property got 20 to 30 mils over the weekend, which will help kickstart some really valuable feed.
So we've come off a relatively dry winter. We did have a few good bands of feed through the station. Rawlinna is about 140 k's from north to south, and we did have some good feed through the centre, and it just held on with a few showers here and there. Down the south, we were really starting to grow some good speargrass, which is our staple grass, which we need a wet winter for to get going. And we'd sort of just managed to kick that off in August down there. The top end of Rawlinna along the trans line was starting to look pretty lacklustre until this recent fall. We had about 22 mils the other night, and the top end should be looking fantastic.
Why is it so important to get a little bit of rain over the summer?
Well, it is important to sort of help us out, but the winter rain's definitely the best. What we've got now certainly helps, but it would have been nice if it was sort of 6 weeks ago, but I'm certainly not complaining about it.
What is it looking like at the moment as opposed to the past couple of Decembers?
Yeah, it's probably better than most Decembers I've seen in recent years. We've come off a very dry period. So, yeah, it is certainly better. We've got a good base of feed in some of the dongas, which will really shoot away with this rain.
Are you confident that there'll be, hopefully for the next few months, a little bit of rain ahead? Now, it might not be, as you said, of that ideal time, but something that will be helpful considering this forecast we've got of La Nina to head across the country?
I think we'll get a bit more. I'm optimistic that we'll end up with a stormy summer with lots of these storms coming through and a few systems moving down from the north. Quite often when we get a cyclone crossing the coast up the north end of the headland sort of area, we end up with the rain-bearing depression down here. I reckon we'll probably end up with some of them this year.
Jimmy Wood from Rawlinna Station talking to Bridget Fitzgerald about why he's happy with the weekend's rain. 22 mils was the official reading at the Rawlinna homestead. It'll mean the sheep will be looking a little bit better when shearing starts in February. It is 18 minutes to 1 o'clock. Just taking a look at the text line, I got a text in here from Mick who says, just referring to that story we ran a bit earlier about a crackdown on foreign investment out of China, he says, with no foreign investment, our industries disappear. Pretty simple. That's from Mick. Now, today, WorkSafe WA started inspecting horticulture properties to ensure farmers are complying with safety regulations. Now, WorkSafe Director Ian Dainty hopes farmers will cooperate and learn instead of getting nervous and defensive.
We always conduct inspections of agricultural environments as part of our annual program. But part of the reason that we've brought some of the inspections forward is in light of these two tragic and unfortunate deaths. And the reality is that the hope is that if we go out other places, we may or may not be able to identify similar circumstances and prevent these sort of things happening again.
So the two deaths you're referring to, one was a 37-year-old Malaysian man who died on a Bullsbrook property, crushed by some machinery, from what I can gather. And the second one was a lady in her 60s who died when she was hit by a tractor at her son's farm at Karabuda. Are you actually conducting investigations into both of those deaths?
Yes, WorkSafe is. It's not my area of responsibility. There is actually an investigations directorate within WorkSafe that is managing that. And as you can understand, they keep that information reasonably confidential. But, yeah, the idea is that we can go and see if we can and identify hazards that you know could prevent reoccurrences of accidents with plant and machinery.
So how many farms will you be inspecting in this particular blitz?
We hope to be somewhere in the region of 15 or 16 properties. We hope that we will do 4 or 5 in the Geraldton Carnarvon area. We will do 4 or 5 in the Esperance Albany region, and we will do the remaining properties on the outskirts of the Perth metro area.
Do the farmers have reason to be worried? Is it a bit like when the police say they're going to be doing breathalyzer tests and they're targeting certain areas?
I don't believe they have reason to be worried, but I do appreciate that any regulator turning up at a property can create a little bit of nervousness. They will be doing inspections in line with the inspections that they normally do. So these farmers will be used, or these agricultural farmers, producers, pastoralists, what have you, they will be used to WorkSafe inspectors attending anyway. So they're not going to do any inspections out of the ordinary. They will be looking at their usual gambit of threats that we've already identified in these industries, such as plant, machinery, forklifts, electrical, fire, and so on. So, no, there should be no reason for them to be scared, as it were, of WorkSafe turning up.
But is it true that you're targeting the horticulture farms?
It is, only in the light that that's where these two incidences occurred.
Yeah. But are you nervous there's going to be more accidents? I mean, the two deaths that you're referring to have happened in the last month, and they're tragic, but we're about to have a fair bit of picking getting underway for some other fruits and vegetables as well. With the COVID travel restrictions, it's resulted in farmers struggling to find enough workers. Are you worried farmers are now resorting to hiring less experienced and possibly younger workers?
I'm not worried. The responsibility obviously remains with the farmer, but we are conscious that things like COVID, and we understand that a lot of these industries rely very heavily on migrant workers, transient workers, backpackers, 457 visa holders, and so on. So we're very conscious of that. And we are interested to see if the restrictions that we've had over the last 8 or 9 months have had an impact on their ability to produce economically and effectively. And we're interested to see how farmers, producers, and growers are managing those restrictions. So it's very much a fact-finding mission for us. We say we're conscious. Again, depending on what we find will depend what we feed back to the industry.
And with these latest inspections, is there an element of education as well as trying to see who's doing the right thing and who's not?
Yes, completely. My foremost part of my role is really about, or I believe it is, in education and information provision to these organisations. It's about talking to people. It's about gaining voluntary compliance. That's always my first aim.
Ian Dainty, one of the directors of WorkSafe. He's responsible for the industrial and regional WorkSafe teams in Western Australia. He was speaking to Richard Hudson about how their offices have just started another round of inspections on mainly horticulture farms in WA. Now, just some comments that have come in via Facebook on that story we ran at the top of the show, looking at those changes to the Foreign Investment Review Board rules and the tightening of approvals for some countries like China. On the ABC Rural Facebook page, Pamela says, wonderful. We don't need to be taken over by China. And Dave says it should have always been this way. It's 13, just gone 12 to 1 o'clock. Now, Australia's leading strawberry breeder is on a delicious quest to release a striking pure white fruit that's ripe when the seeds on its skin turn red. Now, senior scientist Jodie Neal and her team have already perfected the colour, a stunning strawberry that is white-fleshed to its core. But as Jennifer Nichols discovered on a visit to the Marucci Research Centre, the novelty fruit is just a taste of the work being done on new varieties that create consumer choice and keep farmers in business.
So we're here entering our clean glass house, and this is where we keep all our high health material that we're putting out onto farms for trial. And so all of these plants, this is all of our more advanced material and all of our parents that we're using. And these have all been virus tested. So we keep them in here so that they stay disease free. We breed varieties that are targeted for all of Australia's major production regions, from Queensland to Western Australia to Tasmania. So we've, for many years, have been breeding for the subtropical production areas, which is sort of mostly southeast Queensland. But in recent years, we've also expanded. We're now doing temperate. So we have a whole temperate breeding program that's based down in Victoria and also at Stanthorpe in Queensland, so that we're able to grow them and trial them in their natural environments. And then we have another one near Perth in WA for a Mediterranean breeding as well. Last season, 80% of all plants grown commercially were our varieties. This year, that's just winter's just passed, it's even higher. It was around 90% of all the fruit that you would have got in the supermarkets would have been our varieties.
I know that Red Rhapsody was one of your success stories. It has a longer shelf life, it's a larger fruit, so easier to pick, and that deep red colour.
Farmers love it because it's really quick to pick and pack. It's bruise resistant, good even-sized fruit, even shape. So they talk about their packing houses speeding up exponentially when Red Rhapsody comes through. But the supermarkets and consumers also really love it because it has a really long shelf life, so they're not throwing away as much, and it has really consistent flavour.
Now take me over and show me some of your babies on the trays here.
Just behind you here, we have our blush berry, which doesn't have a name yet, but it is one of our new niche strawberry varieties that we're developing. It is a creamy colour on the outside, and then as it's developing, where the sun hits it, like a peach blush on the cheek, it actually gets this little pink on one side, which is just beautiful, and then it's pure white inside.
So white strawberries. What took you down that rabbit hole?
It's about creating choice for consumers. If you go into the supermarket and look at apples, for example, you have your Pink Lady, your Jazz, your Red Delicious, and they all look different, they taste different, and we want to be able to give strawberry eaters that same choice.
We're in the trial patch now. Stepped over the electric fence.
This is to keep things that keep eating our fruit out. And we have some fantastic shots taken with a motion detector camera of hares and various other birds and wildlife eating our fruit who have still gotten in.
There's one there.
Yes. They are very sneaky.
The water bird with a prized strawberry in its mouth.
Yes. They love our fruit. And when we're trying to collect data on yield, it's a problem.
Just tasting the blush strawberry. Mmm. That is lovely. It's a more delicate flavour. Quite sweet.
Yeah. They have really high sugar levels and they're not as tangy as other fruits, so really lovely. We're working towards, hopefully very soon, releasing a pure white strawberry that has red seeds on the outside. So this is one of the ones that will be the parent of whatever we release. It's pure white and white inside. And again, just creating a diversified product. Our blush strawberry was one of the parents of these guys. When we release a white strawberry, we want it to be really good because we don't want to be releasing something that consumers taste and go, we want it to be mind-blowing. And so we're there with the blush, we're getting there with the white. So this one looks like a good one here, if you want to grab.
That one there?
That one there.
Oh, that is pretty. So white, and then with the seeds on the outside, with the contrast.
Yeah, they're just so different looking, but the red seeds make it, they're just beautiful. And that's how you tell that these ones are ripe, when they have red seeds, when they go red. These won't ever be commercially released because they don't have all the traits that we need, such as good shelf life and the flavour where we want it to be yet. So they're a work in progress. We'll use these guys and have already used these guys as parents and cross them with other plants that have the traits that we're wanting to improve and working towards getting a pure white strawberry that is commercially viable as well.
Okay, we'll give it a go. I see what you mean. Still some work to do on that.
Yep.
Flavour's not quite there.
Exactly. So
it's very pretty.
Yes.
But?
Yep. And we will not release anything until it also tastes amazing.
The quest for the pure white strawberry.
Yes, exactly. How much do you love what you do, Dr. Jody Neal?
I actually really, really love what I do. Probably the biggest thing is actually being able to see the direct results of my work impacting farmers and consumers, and seeing that people are able to remain in business because of the varieties that we've been able to release, and that it's making a difference to actual communities and people. But I also get to eat a lot of strawberries, so that's pretty good too.
Dr. Jody Neal from the Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries. She was speaking to Jennifer Nichols. I reckon that does sound like a pretty great job. Those white strawberries sound a bit odd, don't they? But I always say I'll try almost anything. If you want to find out more about that, there is a story up online and it's been posted on the ABC Rural Facebook page. To look at the story strawberry, it's so bizarre. It's just this bright white colour with, as she mentioned there, those red seeds, almost the opposite of your conventional strawberry. On the comments on the Facebook page, mixed feedback, I'm afraid. Kylie says, how about focusing on the red variety first that are supposed to be red on the inside and not flavourless white? Bring back the good old strawberries. There's a comment here from June that says, the bought strawberries have no taste and are hard when you buy them, so I stopped buying them. And there's a comment here from Michael that says, I have two types of white strawberries. They're awesome, as the chooks only eat the red ones, so I actually get some. That sounds pretty good. It's just gone 5-1.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Coming up on The World Today, wild weather lashes communities in Queensland and New South Wales. Our reporter in Byron Bay gives us the latest on the damage to the town's famous beach. The US starts rolling out its first COVID vaccines. It's an operation with huge logistical and ethical challenges. And one-time spook turned master spy novelist John Le Carré has died at the age of 89. We look back at his life and legacy. All that coming up on The World Today.
Now, there was a cattle sale at Mouchet today, 2,855 were yarded. That's up 200 on last week. John Testro's at the Mouchet sale yards now. Now, before we get into the prices, John, we want to know, what was the quality like today? Just having some technical issues. Haven't got John there. We'll come back to John in a moment. Bear with me a second. Now, John Jestro, what was the quality like today?
Are you there?
Hi, John. How was the quality of the cattle at Mouchet today?
Yeah, good afternoon, Jessica. Very mixed. And that probably drove prices as well, too. Big movers today were prime cows and prime bulls down 10 to 15. And grown steers gained 10 to 15 cents. But I'll run through some quotations for you. In the local market, the weaner steers, 370 to 446, down 10 to 15 cents, with the weaner heifers equal at 300 to 410. The pastoral section of those, the weaner steers, 286 to 316, down 10, quality affected. And in the heifers, the lightweights at 220 to 228, firm, with a better at 292 to 360, up 50, and that's on a much better selection. Yearling steers, local, light, 332 to 340 equal, with the heavies at 392 to 414, up 10 to 20 cents. And in the pastoral section of those, the light, 220 to 278 equal, with the heavies at 300 to 372, up by 50 cents. Again, a better quality selection on those. Yearling heifers, local, light, 270 to 320 firm, with the prime at 330 to 386, up 10 to 20 cents. And the pastoral section, the lights at 218 to 215 equal, and the heavies at 280 to 320, again equal. Grown steers, we saw some movement here today. The 5 to 600 kilos at 320 to 384, up 10 to 15, with live export paying to 324 on heavier 6 to 700s. And the pastoral section, they sold from 268 to 350, up by 10 to 15. Bullocks at 280 cents and a very big Friesian steer today here, mate, 216. Grown heifers were all local. They sold from 270 to 334 equal in the cow market, as I said, down 10 to 15 on the primes. And they're still selling at the moment, and a lot of cows still to come, but 250 to 260 was the mark on the better prime. Score 2, 208 to 246 equal, and the processors, the very light score ones at 100 to 200 cents. Grazers were paying 216 to 262 for cows to fatten. In the bull market, to round it all up, prime bulls 258 to 276, down 10 to 15. Medium to export firm at 220 to 348, and light to live export 280 to 392 equal again. Jessica, that completes my show for today. I'm John Testrow from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the ABC.
Thank you so much for that update from Mushe, John Testrow there. A couple of texts in. We've got a text in here. It says 6 inches of rain on the northern New South Wales coast in the last 2 days with more to come. That's a bit of an interesting one to come in. We'll try and bring you some details on tomorrow's show about what that rain might mean for that part of Australia.
It's been a year like no other. Unprecedented. Unimaginable, unfathomable. There's only one way to look back on the year that was 20 bloody 20.
Hello and welcome to the Yearly.
That's the Yearly with Charlie Pickering. Next Wednesday on ABC TV and streaming on iView.
Sounds like a pretty good show. 2020 has been a bit of a bugger, hasn't it? Thank you so much for tuning in today. Remember, for more news anytime, you can always jump on the ABC Rural page.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.